accession number 28361, Reel 29.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 29. You were showing me some photographs of your O groups on Aruba and elsewhere, where you were sitting around on canvas chairs with a map board on an easel, and your headquarters and other officers sitting as well. When you gave orders, did you give them verbally with indications on the map, or were you disposed to give them written orders?
I gave them verbally. I wasn't inclined to give them written orders because, you know, to produce them meant getting someone with a typewriter and bearing in mind that in those days you reproduced them on a Gestetner.
Yeah.
It would all have been rather cumbersome.
Carrying a Gestetner into the field.
It was not a frankly clever idea. So I gave them verbally. You know, just written out in my notebook and just gave them verbally.
What did they do? Did they take notes?
They took notes.
You were saying?
They took notes. Yeah.
Did you always go through the orders procedure to a formula with,
yeah,
you know, mission, enemy,
yeah,
friendly, etc.?
Yes. And I think that helps because people expect it in that order. And if they're sort of tired and stressed in any way, it's familiar. And if you sort of dobble it about all over the place, they're sort of wondering, well, you know, when's the bit about how we get from A to B come up? Whereas if it's in the orders, they'll know it's perfectly well, it'll come in coordinating instructions.
And they can then presumably study the map after the orders.
They can study the map afterwards and talk to the IO.
Yes.
And even come up and say, you know, to me, you know, I've got an idea about this, that, and the other, and put it to me.
Did you often get good ideas coming up that way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How long would it take you to give orders? If you're on an exercise and you seem to have been giving orders on the hoof, as it were, you'd be doing an advanced contact, presumably then you would bump something with your...
Well, that would be done over the radio.
So you get the good news over the radio that you've bumped something up ahead. You would then have to arrange an O group and sort. How long would the O group last?
Well, it depended what the reaction was. If it was bumping the enemy and just putting another company around to the side, I'd just come up and say to the company commander, go round the left and sort those people out.
Or you'd come up on the wireless.
I'd call him up to me, probably,
yes,
and say, there's a problem there, take him round the left flank and sort him out. And that would be all I'd have to say. If it was the whole thing had ground to a halt, and I then wanted to put in a major attack, for example, on this exercise, I think I remember at the end of the first day, I had to put an attack by helicopter to lift a whole lot of guys forward. Then I would get everyone round and quickly scribble out some orders, following the usual format, and give orders as to how I wanted it done.
So this was a considered attack, but it was done in quick tempo.
It was done in quick tempo, yeah. Yeah.
So what an O group for that sort of thing take? An hour or
less
than
nothing
an hour?
Like that.
Like that.
I mean, it would take me perhaps a quarter of an hour to write out what I wanted to say, so I got all the bits in, and at which time concurrent activity, my ops officer was bringing COs up to me or sending them to wherever the O group was going to be. He'd be sending a warning order to the helicopters, designating the landing zone that was going to be the pickup point, warning them of where they were going to take them to. The BC would be working out the fire plan, and at the end of that I would then give orders which would take probably 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, and then depending on the distances to be moved, I then have to allow time for them to brief the companies. So we're talking about an hour probably.
Because you'd give your orders 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, then presumably you'd have to deal with any matters arising, questions for elucidation or chance them to look at the map or put up a suggestion if it was appropriate. So that extends it a little bit, doesn't it? So you've got, 15 to 20 minutes or so at the...
Possibly, because quite often I didn't have questions. You know, not that I didn't ask for them, but there weren't any.
There weren't any.
There weren't any. And people were au fait with what they had to do. They just went off and got on with it.
Yeah. So they would then presumably have to brief their troop commanders.
That's right.
Yes.
Who then had to brief...
Who would then brief
down.
Down to the individual...
Indeed,
And then the whole thing would start rolling.
Yeah.
And so you think that for a considered business, it would take about an hour?
About an hour.
Mounting.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Hmm.
And if you were, if as you said earlier, you were advancing to contact and there was a bump and you decided the proper thing was left flanking on a company or lower scale, you would come up on the radio and say, go left flanking or right flanking. And then that would happen immediately.
The guy he'd have to tell his people what he was going to do. So we're talking about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour to get that done. But sometimes I would call the company commander up to me and say, this is what I want you to do, get on with it. And then he'd have to go back and brief his chaps and then work out a route and take them round.
Well, did they have wireless down to troop level at that stage?
Yeah.
They did. So, presumably, if it was that simple, he could do it over the radio.
He could do it over the radio, yeah.
How far away from you would company HQs be normally when you were doing that sort of.
Well, it depended to a certain extent on the shape and of the ground. But suppose, I mean, Aruba, for example, once one got off that rather open bit you saw, there was a sort of main axis track which tended to go over a series of ridges like that. As the leading company was in front of me, breasted that ridge over there, I'd be probably back on this ridge watching them, and then as they disappeared out of sight, I'd follow up, and so I'd be concertinering all the time myself.
One tactical bound behind.
A tactical bound, and then there's the other company would be the same, so he'd be, what, 500 metres, something like that, behind me, the company commander? So I could just say, join me here.
Mm. Could you normally see forward far enough to...
I could normally see far... Well, it depended on the ground.
Mm.
There would be times when I couldn't see far forward enough because I hadn't sort of got to the position where I could see the next bit.
So it's intermittent.
So it was intermittent. But once contact was established, once they'd got into contact, I mean, you could have a situation where the leading company sort of comes over a crest, and as it's going down the forward slope, its leading platoon or troop is caught on the forward slope and goes to ground. So the company commander's now stopped on the crest. All I've got to do is to go forward and join him.
Mm.
Then I'm alongside him and can see what he can see.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it might be a situation where they're caught going up a slope, so I'm back on that one. And I can't therefore come down the forward slope and join him because otherwise, I'm engaged, and the whole and I'm sort of in the wrong place to be. In which case, I can't speak to him direct. I can talk to him over the radio, but I can bring up the other chap to where I am and say this is the problem. Then I can say to the gunners, I want smoke to try and withdraw that company, an HE on the crest while they withdraw. At the same time, I'm going to send them around that way, and it's all then tied up between the BC and the FOOs, which are with the companies, of course.
What
so the BC's on his radio, he can talk to his FOOs, you see.
Yeah, you've got another channel, haven't you?
And he's got another radio where he's back to the guns. He's actually got two radio operators with him, you see.
How far back would you have the batteries then?
Well, in those days, those were the old pack house, which had a maximum range of 10,000 metres.
This is what, 3.7?
No, they're 105. The 105 pack how, the old Italian 105 pack how, it had a maximum range of 10,000 metres. Mm. So they were about between 5,000 and 6,000. You wouldn't want them more than 6,000 metres back.
No.
And sometimes they'd be a damn sight closer.
Mm.
They might be 2,000 or 3,000 metres behind you. Once we got light gun, which has 17,000 metres, you could afford to have them further back.
Mm. So, how broad a front was the commando on?
Pretty narrow in that situation.
Would it be two troops? Two.
You might have. I think in Aruba, I was generally advancing one company up. Because it was a very narrow axis. One was restrained by the sea on one side, and sort of the way the terrain worked.
Mm.
So there was no point in having a company on your on that side because it would be going so slowly because of the way the terrain. Worked that it was better just to have one company up. But sometimes I would advance the two companies up. I mean, not there, but other places I would.
Mm. So, a company front, how far would it be across the?
I see. I mean, again, depending on the terrain, I mean, it could be 700 metres, something like that.
And that presumably, would the company have two troops?
He had two troops up, I assume,
one
back.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Two up and one back.
Two up and one back. Traditional. And what sort of rate of advance could you expect on a tactical advanced contact like that?
You're not going very fast. I mean, you're talking about 2 miles an hour, something like that. Not fast. Mm. One of the problems is people sort of wandering along in a sort of bimble, not cracking on. Mm. When they're advancing to contact, they're tending to take it slowly because they're, you know, we don't know what's around the corner. Mm. So the leading sections will tend to be going quite slowly. Mm.
What, moving, stopping, moving, looking,
stopping,
listening.
Yeah. And moving in bounds too.
Yes.
Within the troops, you see. Mm.
All that takes time. Station keeping is also...
All of it takes time, and there's a tendency for a lot of hanging about. Mm. And sometimes you've got to say, come on, pick the pace up, we've got to get on, and take the risk you're going to run straight into something which you're not expecting.
Mm. When you were meeting the enemy on Aruba and that sort of exercise, how close would they normally let you get before they open fire? What would be the range of first contact?
Usually about 200 to 300 metres, something like that. Mm. Depending on the visibility, depending on, you know, the way the terrain worked.
Yeah.
So it was about 200 to 300 metres.
So you get within, once you're within effective rifle range,
yeah.
They would then open.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And that was because, you know, the problem of reality on exercises is you can't properly simulate indirect fire. Mm. So whereas in reality, they'd be, you know, if they really wanted to, they could start bringing down artillery fire on you and mortar fire as you advanced. Though they may be, in theory, bringing it down onto you.
No one takes any notice
of it, because there's no shells on the ground, there are no rounds on the ground.
Mm.
That's, you know, one of the unrealities. As Alan Brooke so succinctly put it after the First World War, troops on exercise maneuver as if artillery fire didn't exist.
Well, is there a cure for that disease?
The only cure for it, I suppose, is really good battlefield simulation, which takes a lot of time.
Battle schools attempted it, didn't they?
Battle schools attempted and did very well. And a lot of the exercises in the Second World War were done with live ammunition.
And that incurs casualties.
Incurs casualties, but then they were allowed casualties. They were allowed a certain proportion. You couldn't get away with it in peacetime.
Mm.
And therefore, it is a problem simulating artillery and any sort of indirect fire.
You did the series of looping advances and landings in Aruba, which is a rather peculiar terrain.
Mm. We didn't land from the sea, did a series of helicopter envelopments.
Ah,
really.
So it wasn't amphibious?
No, we landed from the sea by, there was no place where you could land landing craft on Aruba,
so
except on the civilian beaches. So everything was done by helicopter.
Mm.
So nothing, that you couldn't take anything that wasn't liftable by helicopter. Mm.
Where did you go after Aruba? Where's the next?
So, for example, I mean, why we took trailers was trailers were an easy way of transporting stuff around. Because in your trailer would be your charging engine for your... We didn't have any FFRs, you see, no vehicles. So your heavy sets had to be charged that, and then there'd be the little CP tent in there, and one or two of the little chairs would go in there. And that would be it. I mean, the commander headquarters would have just one trailer.
And presumably it had to be dragged along by the men.
So what happened was it was just dumped. The reason it was handy to have it on wheels, at least you could move this load around by pushing it.
Mm.
And then when you moved it to the next place, it was just lifted forward by helicopter.
Ah, I see. So you weren't...
You didn't drag it. No,
you didn't
have
it along with you.
No. Mm. It was just it was a package on wheels, if you like. It could have been a pallet, but it was easier to have it on wheels because it meant that when they landed it here, you could move it to here, or you could move it a few yards, and then when you wanted to move it, you just hooked it onto a helicopter and moved it forward.
Was there any idea at that time?
And all the guns had to move that way as well.
They did, by displacing forward by helicopter?
Yeah.
And their ammunition too.
Yep. Well, I mean, it was an exercise. This is the unreality. Mm. There was no ammunition. Mm. This is an unreality. You have to cater for when you go into reality of how much helicopter lift, and we can come on to that later, has to be devoted to moving gun ammunition, which is a hell of a lot. If you don't have any roads,
expenditures nearly always exceed expectations.
And so the other reality, unreality of these exercises, well, we were not moving ammunition.
What about casualties? Did you simulate casualties?
Casualties were simulated, and they were lifted back to the LPH, which was offshore.
Did you have any idea of using helicopters as command posts? Because that's something that one might.
No, not in that country. Too open. The only way you can, the only way one would use it would be by sort of hovering. And the minute you come up, you're exposed to enemy fire. You get shot down. So the other option is to go up very high.
And you lose contact.
And you lose contact. And you may not lose radio contact, but you lose visual contact. You can't see what's going on. And quite honestly, I think it's a complete waste of time. I think a helicopter command post is actually an overrated form of command, in my opinion.
What happened when you finished your training on Aruba?
We then went and did another exercise, this one in Vieques. In fact, it was split into two halves. The first half was field firing training. So we had a week or so of field firing training. So they had got very good ranges there. So we were doing everything, grenades, live firing with the mortars and guns, live air, close air support, practicing the FAC, company attacks, live company attacks, live troop attacks, live commando attack as the final thing, a night attack with artillery and mortars. And then we re-embarked and came under command of an American brigade and did an exercise with another US Marine battalion against an enemy which they had put in. So I had a sort of brigade command. So the first time I'd done an exercise as a CO with someone else over the top of me.
Yeah. Who provided the aircraft for close air support? Was this
Americans.
American.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Were their coordination procedures the same as ours?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
How far could you actually move on this live firing range? How long was the run on it if you were going forward?
It was, I'm just trying to remember how long it was. It was about 4,000 or 5,000 metres, something like that. It wasn't a very imaginative range. It was, you had to sort of go in that direction.
Yes.
But you could coordinate guns and mortars and that sort of thing live.
Mm. What sort of targets did they have on it?
Oh, nothing. Just, paper targets.
Ah. Did they have any travelling or pop-up targets?
No,
or anything like
nothing like that. No.
What was the ground like in Vieques?
It was, Vieques was quite heavily wooded. Quite bumpy. The field firing range was almost bare because all the trees had been blown away.
Yes. Very hard to keep trees growing on there.
Indeed.
For live firing.
Indeed. And so that was a sort of bare ass bit of country. But the approaches to it were actually quite thick. And it was. So that was a field firing, but our exercise under the Americans was all, no live firing at all. It was all.
Blanks,
because we were against an opposed enemy. And it was at that stage that I, having done one night attack, I decided to try something new, which was a way of advancing at night instead of having a huge sort of snake of people.
On a one-man
front. Was advancing in what I call company column. so that once one had got off the, one was astride the axis, you could have two up and one back.
What, as in company snakes?
No, what we had was, I came up with an idea, which we tried, and we then always used it after that, was that the way that a troop advanced was you had a section in file like that, two lines, a section in like that, troop headquarters in the middle, and his rear section again in two lines. So you had two chap in the middle, all fairly close together. The visibility had to be reasonably good at night.
Not so it's half platoon columns.
Yeah, short. That's right. Then the next one would be next door to it,
yeah.
And then the company would be the same. So the company was advancing like that, and everyone was responsible for navigation. And then what happened when you hit something was that the troop that had been advancing could do that. And open out and start
going
to skirmish lines and get cracking. Mm. When we were told to do a night attack at the end of this exercise with the Americans, I had plenty of time to do a recce, which I did by helicopter, and that's the advantage of helicopter. You can go forward, and I sort of snuck the helicopter forward at almost ground level to where I wanted to have my start line, and I could see the objective. Mm. It was in daylight. And then I snuck it back again. And then I prepared my orders. And then I got the company's commanders together. And I said, what we're going to do tonight is this. And I want you to try this formation. And you're to go away and rehearse it now. Until, you know, we have plenty of time. And it worked, actually. And after that, I always used that formation at night. I christened company column for lack of better anything better to call it, but the idea being to try and avoid this tendency at night, for it, you know, to have these huge snakes of people, which makes control quite difficult.
It must indeed, yes.
And of course, we were very much in the era of with night vision being quite night vision equipment. There wasn't much night vision equipment. The only night vision equipment I had was I had some. I didn't have Milan, actually. I still had wombats. And they had NODs, as they were called, night observation devices, which was a huge, bloody great night sight. And there was no tank threat. So to the huge irritation of the anti-tank crew commander, I said, all your NODs are to be taken off your anti-tank guns, and you're to issue, I had six anti-tank guns, you will issue one NOD to each company, and I want one. And there was one spare, which I gave to the recce troop, or something like that. And so the company commander, using this night object, which had quite a good range, it was a hefty great thing, he could actually sort of scan his company and see what they were up to, and so talk to them on the radio.
He could keep visual contact.
He could get visual contact. Yeah. So that was the only night observation device we had, actually.
There was one time a very large and cumbersome thing called Twiggy. I don't know if you ever...
Yes, which was, had a big that. Sort of... Yes.
It's gather all the starlight in and so on.
Yes. Well, the NOD was a passive night device. It was one that worked on gathering in the ambient light. It didn't throw a beam, and it wasn't infrared. No.
Mm.
No. But it was quite effective actually, and certainly in the Caribbean. With a lot of starlight, and if there wasn't much cloud around, you've got quite good vision with it, actually.
Who were the Americans who you were joined
they,
with? Who
they
were
the
Americans. They
the American Marines.
Marines.
There was a sort of American Caribbean ready group or something that was in LPHs and other landing craft, which permanently sort of floated about the Caribbean. Mm. And they used to land on Vieques for training, because Vieques was very much an American marine training island. Mm. The whole island was theirs to play on. The only threat were cowboys, because they used to run cattle wild on these islands, and the cowboys were genuine cowboys, only they were sort of, you know, a gaucho type guys who rode horses. And they were very good horsemen, and they were the biggest thieves you ever come across. If you leave anything lying around in your camp, they'd be in on their horse and and away and off before you could do anything about it.
Were they native to the island? Or
yeah.
They were?
Yeah.
I mean, did the cattle get in the way at all?
I mean, it was a cattle. There was, as I understand it, a very sort of hard-nosed rule. If the cattle wandered onto the field firing range, that was the fault of the cowboys. Bad luck, and they were all down one end of the island. Though it was part of the training area, you could only do dry training in the area where the cattle were. And they were all, you know, they were sort of rather like, you know, the Wild West. The cattle weren't penned in; they were just wandering
they were
about,
rolling free.
Rolling free, yeah.
So you mentioned a battalion and also a brigade. Were these all Marines from
There was a brigade headquarters.
Yes.
And then there was a Marine battalion who are on our side. So it was us and a Marine battalion. So it was a two-unit brigade.
Right.
And then the enemy were either a company or a couple of companies from another battalion or came from somewhere else. I can't remember where they came from.
And you were working alongside the Americans.
Yeah.
How was the coordination with them on that exercise then? Was that?
Well, they told me what my objectives were and what I was to do.
Yeah.
And I found they left me alone, possibly because they weren't quite sure how to deal with me. I don't mean me personally, but the Brits. My American ops officer, a Marine, was pretty scathing about the brigade headquarters. I mean, they were his own countrymen, but he said they were pretty useless, in his opinion.
On what ground?
Well, because they used to block up the radio nets all the time by chattering on the net. It was very difficult to get messages through, and he used to go absolutely spare, having been used to 18 months worth of British fairly terse radio procedure. This sort of gibbering away on the radios he found pretty irritating. And so sometimes you just couldn't get your SIP rep through. You had to send a chap with a cleft stick pretty well to their headquarters to give them a SIP rep on what you were up to.
Well, I mean, were these exercises sophisticated or were they straightforward and simple?
Oh, they're very simple. I mean, I think the sort of scenario was that this island had been captured by some guerrilla group and we were taking it back. Very simple stuff. Not complicated. No armour. You know, the enemy was unsophisticated.
Small groups and lightly armed.
Yeah, I mean, up to sort of company. I think the final enemy position we were attacking in our night attack was a company or something like that.
Were they dug in?
Yeah. No. They dug in. They had all night, most of the afternoon and the night to dig in. And so we had quite a nice little battle on the objective. Yeah. And then when the whistle blew, then they would immediately start exchanging kit. You know,
what sort of kit did our fellows find desirable?
Right, I can tell you what the kit that they found desirable from the Americans. The most desirable object was a thing called a poncho liner, which was a camouflaged, quilted thing, rather like a miniature duvet, very thin, with tapes all round it, and you could tie it into your poncho. It was only any use in that sort of climate. You could put it inside your poncho and convert it into a little mini sleeping bag, which was rather better than what we had. So the poncho liner was number one gizit that was required. And number two bit of kit was usually their sheath knife, which they had, which they called a K-bar, which was rather like a Bowie knife, which they were all issued with. That was highly popular. What they wanted from us was our jerseys, which they weren't equipped with at the time, and they thought the idea of a woolly pulley was absolute heaven. Mm. And our 24-hour ration packs, which were so much better than the muck that they were given to eat. So that was really what was tended to be exchanging.
Did you have a policy on that? Were you trying to discourage it, or were you?
My only policy was, if you parade next morning without your woolly pulley because you've given it away and you've been stupid enough.